Hello and welcome to this digital content of the class Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2, which is a direct continuation of its first part, Physical Chemistry of Polymers 1, taught at the Johannes Gutenberg University of Mainz. My name is Sebastian Seifert and I'm a representative of that very discipline, meaning the core focus of my research and teaching is in exactly that field, Physical Chemistry of Polymers. If you want to get in touch with me, you can do this most effectively and easily via email. Just send a message targeted to the address sebastian.seifert@ud-mainz.de. The target of the lecture series Physical Chemistry of Polymers, with both its parts, is to achieve an understanding of the relations between structure and properties of polymer materials, thereby connecting microscopic molecular parameters to macroscopic material functions. In the first part of this lecture series, we have illustrated that endeavor in the conceptual picture of a bridge connecting the imaginary continents of polymer chemistry and polymer engineering that are seemingly separated from each other by an impassable water body. Physical chemistry of polymers now arcs between these two shores by creating a bridge between them, which in turn relies on three solid pillars, each representing one of the three contributors to that field, which are single-chain statistics, multi-chain interactions, and chain dynamics. In the first part of this lecture series, we have laid down the fundament of that bridge. Meaning, if we stay in the four-set picture, we have erected the three fundamental pillars for our bridge. In the present second part of this lecture series, it is our intent to finalize that bridge by picking up our knowledge from part one and applying it to polymer systems. That means to systems that consist of multiple polymer chains and possibly also another fluid medium. As indicated already, our prime focus is on structure-property relations, and the most predominant class of properties of polymers that has rendered them ground-shifting in our materials world is their mechanical properties. That means this present second part of our lecture series will have a prime focus on deriving structure-property relations, particularly focusing on mechanical properties. Along with that, on our way, we will also learn about the methodology to probe mechanical characteristics of polymers. In a secondary focus in this lecture, in view of our overall aim to derive structure-property relations, we will also focus on a methodology to probe structures. For polymer systems, the most predominant methodology to accomplish that is based on scattering. So that means this lecture will essentially comprise only two main chapters: a large one focusing on rheology and mechanics of polymer systems, and a comparably short but nevertheless still content-rich chapter on scattering analysis of polymer systems. The digital lecture will come to you via two media. Just as in the classical non-digital, that means personal presence-based lecture format, that has been in use by mankind ever since scientific insights have been discovered, the transfer of scientific knowledge relies on auditive and visual elements. The auditive element is my talking, and the visual element is graphical illustrations, written mathematical expressions, and sketched schematics. Classically, both is delivered together to you in a standard lecture hall format, where a lecturer in front of the learning group talks and uses Blackboard plus projection media for the visual element. In this digital class, there is two realizations of how these two elements of knowledge transfer can reach you. In other words, this digital lecture is offered to you in two different ways of conception. The first way is a video format offered on our university's platform Panopto, where you hear the auditive element from your computer loudspeakers or headphones and concurrently see the visual element on screen. Alternatively, you can also receive and conceive this lecture with the two elements more split. The lecture is also offered to you as a series of audio podcasts that only transfer the auditive element, whereas the visual element can be received parallel to listening to these podcasts on the basis of PDF copies of lecture scripts that come along with the lesson units. These scripts summarize the core content of each lesson unit of the lecture as bullet point note downs alongside two schematic sketches and graphical illustrations, just as handwritten notes that you would take during a classical lecture hall setting of this class would look like. These PDF scripts are actually excerpted from a larger textual basis for this class, which is the textbook Physical Chemistry of Polymers, A Conceptual Introduction, published by De Gruyter, with the first edition having appeared in April 2020. This textbook lays out to you even further content and deeper insight than it is discussed in this digital lecture, and the PDF copies of the lecture scripts are essentially excerpts of the chapters 5 and 6 of this textbook. Note that, for that reason, the section numbering in this class actually starts with chapter 5 and continues with chapter 6. thereby also guaranteeing a direct continuous transition from the preceding chapters 1 to 4 featured in the first part of this lecture series. Both the PDF copies of the lecture scripts and the audio files of the podcast are offered to you for download or in situ access on the website www.seifert, that's my name with double F, minus group.de, which is the web presence of my scientific working group at our university. And on that website, you find a section teaching, and in that section teaching, you find a subsection physical chemistry of polymers 2. And there you find and can play the audio podcasts. And there you also find the PDF copies of the lecture scripts for download. Depending on what type of learning person you are, either the converged video broadcast on Panopto or the split audio podcast listening alongside to reading or viewing at the lecture scripts may be more suitable for you. Both is possible for you to do by choosing the one or the other format for conceiving this class. If you're uncertain what is your preference, I suggest that you just try out both. Use the one format for the first lesson unit and use the other format for the second lesson unit and then compare and see what works better for you. In addition to the lecture, there is a second teaching format in the form of a seminar. Information on how this looks like and where and when it will take place can be found on our lecture website. A last technical question that is certainly remaining on all your minds now is, what about the exam? So far, in the past, the exam has always taken place in oral form, that means in a one-on-one setting, or actually one-on-two settings, between me, the lecturer, my colleague Wolfgang Schertl, who served as a protocol writing person in that setting, and you, the student being examined. In that setting, we normally speak about the content of this class for a total duration of 30 minutes, and the questions asked in that examination are not so much questions of kind, how exactly do you calculate this and that, or how are the formulas describing these and those phenomena, but more targeting at fundamental conceptual understanding, in a sense like, why actually do polymers show these and that very interesting rheological properties, and how can we conceptually describe this mathematically? That means, during the examination, we more ask for proportionality relations between quantities of interest, meaning how does this quantity scale with that quantity, and not so much about the exact equation, including proportionality factors between them. The most typical way of how this is asked for is, can you draw a log-log diagram illustrating how this quantity scales as a function of that quantity for this case and for that case? Commonly, we offer two examination periods wherein which these one-on-one or two-on-one examinations can be scheduled. One at the very end of the lecture period, meaning at the beginning of the lecture-free time, and the other at the end of the lecture-free time, close to the restart of the new semester. Information on how exactly and when exactly this will take place in this current semester will reach you in due course on our lecture website. Okay, after that technical information on the, let's say, terms and conditions of this lecture, let's get started with our lecture content. We have briefly mentioned already that polymers have had tremendous impact on all our lives in the last, that means the 20th century. In very general, ages in mankind's history have always been named after the most impactful materials that were in use by people to those times. Classical famous examples are the Stone Age, the Iron Age, and the Bronze Age. Following this scheme of classification, I would say that we can rightfully name the 20th century of mankind as the Polymer Age, because polymer and polymer-based materials entered and reshaped many, if not even all, aspects of our lives during that time. In that, there is one class of properties for which polymers have especially achieved the aforesaid astonishing breakthrough, their mechanical properties. You can get an illustration of this when you just spontaneously think about polymers. What do you think about? Do you think about a material then that is beneficial for its electrical semiconductivity? No, you don't. Or do you think about a material that has outstanding optical transparency? Also not. What you think about, though, is a material that exhibits a strikingly broad range of mechanical characteristics and an amazing mechanical strength. Just think about the most common intuitive picture that many people have in mind when they think about polymers or plastics, a plastic bag. Such an item is capable of carrying a large load, whereas its own weight is practically negligible compared to that. You may know this from shopping, when your fully loaded plastic shopping bag rather appears to be at risk of ripping your hands off than to rip apart itself. As we will see throughout this lecture, polymers are far more than that. In view of mechanics, they can actually be everything. They can be viscous fluids, they can be viscoelastic liquids or solids, they can be elastic rubbers, or they can be hard plastics. This is what has distincted polymer materials and made them enter and reshape our lives. And the most fantastic aspect in that context is that all those versatile mechanical properties can be rationally understood in view of how they are related to chemical structures. That means those properties are powerfully tunable and tailorable in rational materials design. And, as just indicated, they turned out to be highly beneficial in a myriad of applications that turned out to be both promising in prolonging our lives, this is the biomedical field, but also to make it more comfortable. This latter field is the one into which polymers have entered in mass commodities. As mentioned already a couple times to this point, the prime goal of our lecture series and of physical chemistry of polymers in general is to understand the relations between structure and properties of polymer-based materials. Which, due to all the aforesaid, here in this context means with a special focus on the mechanical properties. That means a large portion of this class will focus on polymer rheology. What is rheology? The word rheology derives from the Greek rheos, which means flow, and logos, which means understanding. With that, rheology is the understanding of flow. In that realm, we can generally distinguish between two elementary cases of materials' mechanical response. In a black and white scheme, materials are either elastic solids, like a rubber band, or viscous liquids, like water or honey or syrup. These two extremes are both described by very simple physics, actually. Let's consider the ideal elastic case first. In such a material, any deformation energy introduced into the specimen by application of an external force, or stress, which is force normalized to the cross-sectional area onto which the force acts, is stored within the material specimen elastically. That means, upon application of such a deforming force or stress, the material is immediately deformed to an extent proportional to the extent of applied stress, or vice versa. Whereas immediately upon relief of the external load, the material releases the stored deformation energy and snaps back to its original shape. The proportionality of the extent of deformation, which we also refer to as strain, and the force or stress that causes that, is expressed by Hooke's law, as written down in equation 5.1. Stress sigma is proportional to strain epsilon, with a constant of proportionality named E, which stands for elastic modulus. This quantity is also often referred to as Young's modulus. In the notion of equation 5.1, this quantity at a first glance appears to be just an engineering property, a constant of proportionality that tells us how hard it is to deform the material. What extent of deformation will cause what extent of stress in the material, or vice versa, what extent of applied force will lead to what extent of deformation. From the viewpoint of physical chemistry, however, this constant is not only an engineering constant of proportionality, but actually an elementary material parameter that quantifies how much of the external deformation energy is stored within the material's structure. In view of our aim to derive structure-property relations, we can already guess that this must have to do with how the microscopic structure of the material is constituted. If the elastic modulus tells us how hard it is to macroscopically deform the material by application of a given external load on a microscopic scale, this must correspond to the energy density between the building blocks of the material that we need to work against when attempting to deform it. And this in turn must originate of the energies that are operable between the material's building blocks and their mutual distances, which in turn also has to do with their sizes. As a little outlook at this point already, when we think about a polymeric rubber material, this has a nanostructure of a polymer network, composed of network chain strands tied together by cross-linking junctions. Macroscopic deformation of this specimen is microscopically accommodated by deformation of these network strands, which roughly translates to an energy increment of kBT per network chain, along with sizes, that means distances between the cross-linking junctions, of a few nanometers. Dividing the one by the cube of the other gives us an energy density. The unit of the energy in the numerator of that ratio is newton meters, and the unit of the cube of the length, that means the volume in the denominator of that ratio, is cube meters. That means the total unit of the ratio is newton meters divided by cube meters, that means newton per square meters, which corresponds to the unit of a pressure or stress, pascal. This is exactly what we also would expect for the elastic modulus, according to equation 5.1. Because in that equation, on the left-hand side, we have a stress, which has the unit pascals, whereas on the right-hand side, in the epsilon, we have a dimensionless quantity, as epsilon is the relative extent of deformation, the change of the length of the specimen divided by its length before deformation, and that is dimensionless. That means to give the same dimension on the right and on the left-hand side, the quantity E, the elastic modulus, must have the unit pascals, which, as we have just seen, also corresponds to the unit of an energy density. And if we now take the orders of magnitude that we've just named in the example of a rubbery specimen, energy of kVt and size scale of a few nanometers, the resulting energy density is in the range of some gigapascals. And as we will see later on throughout our class, this is exactly what the elastic modulus of typical rubbery specimen is. With that, we can conclude already that we have actually just approached a structure property relation. The capability for energy storage of a material specimen is directly related to its microscopic structure, and as we will also see later on throughout our class, to the internal dynamics in that structure. As the structural part, which we have just seen, is reflected in the elastic modulus, this quantity is a physical, quantitative expression of a structure property relation. Equation 5.1 tells us even more. As soon as we relieve the external load, the material will immediately snap back into its original shape, and the stored mechanical energy is released back. That means elastic deformation is instantaneously and fully reversible. All these mechanical characteristics of an ideal elastic solid that we have just discussed can be illustratively visualized and conceptualized in a simplifying fashion by an analogy of a mechanical element of a spring, as illustrated in figure 62a. Next to that graphical illustration of a spring, you also see Hooke's law again in a handwritten form, along with an allocation of the three parameters in it. A second stereotype of mechanical behavior is an ideal viscous fluid. In such a material, the exertion of an external stress also causes deformation. But in this case, the stress is proportional not to the deformation itself, but to its rate, to its time dependence. That means, in this case, upon relief of the stress, the material will not snap back to its original shape, but retain deformed. From that, we can conclude that in this case, we don't have any energy storage in the material, but by contrast, the energy of deformation is dissipated within the material to heat, which is then transferred to its environment. Viscous deformation is therefore irreversible. Just like Hooke's law, we can also set up a fundamental equation to describe that, which is Newton's law, given in equation 5.2. In this law, stress is proportional to the rate of strain with a constant of proportionality referred to as viscosity. Again, to approach an illustration of the physics behind that equation, we can have a look onto its units. On the left-hand side, just like in Hooke's law, we have stress, which has the unit pascals, whereas on the right-hand side, we here now have a time derivative of the dimensionless quantity strain, which has the unit of inverse seconds. To assure that both sides of the equation have the same unit, the concept of proportionality, viscosity, must therefore have the unit pascal seconds. Just like the elastic or Young's modulus, we can view the viscosity as both an engineering property that tells us what rate of deformation will cause what extent of stress in a material, but also from the viewpoint of physical chemistry, wherefrom we can identify viscosity as a material parameter that quantifies us how much resistance the material's building blocks exert on mutual displacement, which is the microscopic process behind the macroscopic phenomenon of flow. Little footnote in that context. Later on, we will see that these two quantities that we have just introduced, the elastic modulus and viscosity, are actually connected to one another by one of the most central equations in the field of rheology. Viscosity equals elastic modulus times relaxation time, which is a fundamental time constant denoting to us how long it takes for the material's building blocks to move over distances equal to their own size, meaning how long it takes them to switch their positions, how long it takes until they can migrate over macroscopic distances, macroscopic relative to their own size. We will address and discuss this quantity in much more detail later, of course, but for the moment, even the very simplistic illustrative view that we've just had on it tells us how much microscopic resistance there is on switch of the material's building blocks positions, which of course corresponds to what resistance is there against macroscopic flow of the material. From this viewpoint, the elementary equation viscosity equals elastic modulus times relaxation time does actually already unfold deep sense. According to that equation, viscosity has to do with or is composed of how much energy is initially stored within the material and how long it then takes to dissipate it. Just like the spring element that represents to us an ideal elastic solid, also the viscosity of an ideal viscous fluid has a mechanical representation, which is a dashpot, as illustrated in figure 62b. Next to that sketch, we also find a handwritten notion of Newton's law, along with an allocation of the three parameters in it. These two extremes are clearly and undoubtedly observed in materials that display these stereotypes. For example, if we think about a piece of metal wire, such as a copper wire, this definitely behaves as an ideal elastic solid. We can stretch it, which causes a stress inside the material, and these two quantities are proportional to each other, connected by the constant of proportionality, elastic modulus. The content of a cup of water, by contrast, is a stereotype of an ideal viscous fluid, in which Newton's law is applicable. We will see throughout our class that polymers actually display both elastic characteristics and viscous characteristics, depending on the timescale of observation and the experimental conditions, most predominantly depending on temperature. And with polymers, I hereby mean the same material specimen, actually. Meaning, the same material, the very same specimen, can behave like an elastic solid at one set of conditions, and it can behave like a fluid under another set of conditions. At yet other conditions, even hybridized or mixed appearances are observed. We refer to that as viscoelasticity. Polymers are a prime representative of a class of materials that displays rich and versatile viscoelastic mechanics. This is what actually makes polymer mechanical properties unique and useful. To achieve an understanding of such mechanical properties, we first of all must start with probing them. This is performed in a rheological experiment. In such an experiment, we apply a deformation to a material and measure how hard it is to achieve that. In that endeavor, we can apply deformation in two different forms. To illustrate that, let's have a look into a material specimen that has the shape of a cube, as illustrated in figure 63. Here we regard a cube with three edges, denoted A, B, and C. There is multiple ways of how deformation can be applied to that specimen. Two of them are the most relevant in the field of rheology: uniaxial strain, as shown in figure 63a, and shear deformation, as shown in figure 63b. In the case of uniaxial strain, we apply uniform stress onto the AB face of the cube, which is defined as the force we apply normal to that plane, normalized to the facial area. This stress causes a strain of the specimen, which we quantify by the extent of stretching of the C edge of the cube, delta C, normalized to the original length of the edge C. In the case of shear deformation, by contrast, stress is exerted onto the AC face of the cube. This causes a shearing of the body, which extent, also referred to as shear strain, is given by the extent of deformation of the C edge, delta C, normalized to the original length of the edge B of the cube, which also corresponds to the tangent of the shearing angle alpha, as denoted in figure 63b. In both cases, we can apply both Hooke's and Newton's laws, as denoted in handwritten form, underneath the two sketches in figure 63. Note the delicate difference. In Hooke's law, in the case of uniaxial strain, we have the constant of proportionality E, which is the elastic or Young's modulus. In the case of shear deformation, however, that constant of proportionality is named G, which refers to the shear modulus. These two moduli are, of course, related to one another, but they are not the same. They differ from each other by a geometrical factor, as denoted in equation 5.3. E is 2 times g times 1 plus mu, whereby mu is named Poisson's ratio, which is a quantification of the Poisson effect. This is a phenomenon according to which a material will expand in two directions if we compress it into the one direction perpendicular to these two. Or vice versa, it will shrink in two directions perpendicular to a third one into which we stretch the material. The physics behind this is just a conservation of the volume. If we make the material longer in one direction, it must get thinner in two others if it shall retain its original volume. And if we make the material shorter in one direction, it must get thicker in two others for the same reason. The Poisson ratio is a quantification of that effect, as detailed in equation 5.4. For incompressible objects, these are such that retain their volume upon deformation, such as most fluids do, we have a Poisson's ratio of 0.5. This value commonly also applies to polymers, because many polymer samples are indeed incompressible and show conservation of their volume upon deformation. In that case, according to equation 5.3, the elastic modulus E turns out to be 3 times the shear modulus G. As a further note, the two most predominant cases of deformation shown in figure 62 must be pointed out to be not the only possible ones. We can generally apply a force or stress to many of the faces or edges of the material specimen and measure the resulting strain in many different other directions. The two that are shown in figure 63 are the most predominant ones in the field of rheology, but they are not the only ones. To fully and correctly account for that, we must actually write Hooke's and Newton's laws in tensor form, A tensor form of Hooke's law is given in equation 5.5. This is the form in which any deformation in any direction and any result in any direction can be accounted for. This is outlined to you in full detail in equation 5.6 and figure 64. In our lecture, however, we focus on the two most predominant cases shown in figure 63. With that, we're at the end of this first lesson unit. We have developed a methodological toolbox to perform and consider rheological experiments. If the material world would be as black and white as we have painted it today, we would actually be quite soon at the end of this class already. Fortunately, however, for polymers, this is not the case. They display a much richer, or to stay in our picture, a more colorful mechanical behavior, for which we can spend a large portion of this whole lecture on. As we will see, a prime reason for that is the elementary molecular scale flexibility of polymer chains and the predominance of entropy in view of their shape. There is a beautiful textbook on the physics of soft matter that I always name a bedtime storybook, as it's written so beautifully, authored by the Italian physicist Roberto Piazza. It's named Soft Matter, the stuff that dreams are made of. In this book, as an Italian, the author compares polymers to his country people by saying, "Polymers are like Italians, messy, but very flexible." In the following course of our lecture series, we will see what mechanical richness emerges from that.